Record. Right. Terry, okay. just so I can just introduce you really quickly on my recording.
Sure.
You're retired now, but what was your original position?
I was a professor in human health and nutritional sciences at the University of Guelph in Ontario, Canada. And I spent my professional life studying carbohydrate metabolism in the human. And fairly late in my career, I had an opportunity to start to examine how carbohydrates were actually digested and assimilated into the human body.
Yeah.
And very naively at that point thought, well, I should use a food, and what's the a nice simple food that's rich in carbohydrates that people eat? Bread. And I then rapidly found out bread is an extremely complex food. And its properties change not only with ingredients, but how it's made, how it's baked, how it's served. And so our first study, excuse me, I'm getting over a bad cold.
Sorry.
our first study compared different types of bread, and we had two different white breads in with the treatments. And one was a regular yeast-risen white bread, and the second one was a sourdough bread that was identical in ingredients, but using sourdough instead of yeast. And we were very surprised in our findings that of the breads we tested, that in fact the one that showed the most moderate response in blood sugar and in insulin, which is managing the sugar, was in fact the sourdough bread.
So it had the most moderate response in
blood sugar, and
therefore insulin.
And equally surprising was that the response in insulin was not pronounced.
Does that mean that the response in insulin was not pronounced? What does that mean?
Well, if I give you two different carbohydrate challenges to ingest, and one is processed in a different way from the other, such let's say that sample number one gives a lower response and it isn't as dramatic rise in blood sugar, then you'd expect, well, the insulin response, which is directing the carbohydrate into muscle and liver and so on, would be altered. And so this could be, from a health perspective, either a good thing or a bad thing. We prefer, from a health perspective, to keep things as close to normal, as homeostatic as we can. We don't like large swings in hormones and blood nutrients and so on. And so the fact that both the nutrient, blood sugar, and the insulin were moderated by the sourdough process really surprised us. And I should emphasize that in these challenges, the subjects were ingesting the same amount of carbohydrate in every trial. So it's not as if, well, bread number one had 80 grams of carbohydrate and bread number two only had 20. The available carbohydrate was identical. So we then explored this further, looking at other hormones and other bread recipes and so on. But consistently, we found that sourdough was associated with this more moderate blood sugar response. And once I presented this information and wrote it up and it was published and interacted with various people, a number of individuals who had experience in Asian cooking and Asian foods and so on, as well as other ethnicities, pointed out that historically, a number of fermented foods, which I wasn't familiar with at all, have been associated with good health. So that suggesting that there could be something with the fermentation process, whether it was specifically sourdough or not, that was important. Although we haven't published the work, and now I'm retired and not as excited about writing up research articles and having them rejected by journals, one of the food scientists I was working with at the time, who was really a food chemist, suspected that the sourdough process itself was altering the structure of some of the starch in the bread such that it would be digested somewhat more slowly and be more easily in a controlled manner, would be more assimilated into the body in a slower process. Not that it would act like a resistant starch, but it would be approaching that sort of property so that it might process down through the intestines a little further, be broken down more slowly, and be incorporated. And he did produce preliminary information that supported his theory.
What's his name?
His name is, oh God. Now you're asking an old head that hasn't worked with him. Steve Ku, C-I-U, at the University of Guelph.
C-I-U, Steve Ku.
C-I-U. And he actually officially, although he's associated with the University of Guelph, officially he's in Agriculture Canada, which has a research lab at Guelph, and it's Agriculture Food.
Oh, you can maybe email me the details later, because that sounds like something I maybe be fascinating to follow up. In real terms, I appreciate the fact that spikes in insulin and insulin problems are behind a lot of our modern day health problems.
Yes.
Would this have a significant impact on most people's health, eating sourdough as a daily bread? I mean, would it have a major impact, do you think?
Well, I don't think it would make a significant impact on the healthy individual who has a good lifestyle. Mm. Sadly, those are no longer the majority of our societies. And those who are risk for type 2 diabetes or have type 2 diabetes, every time they're having a simple carbohydrate in their food, and have poorly controlled blood sugar and erratic, then those individuals could well be, and I'm speculating at this point, but could well benefit from having a sourdough bread rather than a normal yeast risen bread. Mm-hmm. One of my co-workers, Richie Yada, who's also a food scientist and was very involved in this work, is a type 2 diabetic. And he had been eating different types of breads, trying to figure out which one would be best. And he told me that he switched to a sourdough bread and that his blood sugars had never been better.
So really, anybody who has any kind of disorders with blood sugar should, if they're going to eat bread, then it should be a sourdough.
That's what I would suggest. But as I say, I need to emphasize as a boring ivory tower scientist that the study has not been done.
You did two studies, Terry. How many people did they involve? And when what years were they done?
The work was done over a period of about 6 or 7 years. I'm guessing now in the early, around 2004 to about 2010, probably 2009. And it was looking at a variety of aspects. And to go a little further, we also looked at, as you might guess, I suppose, whole wheat breads, whole grain breads, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And in our first study, something that really surprised us was that the whole wheat bread that we used was no better. If I say better, I suppose that's a judgment call, but in a way, no better than the regular white bread.
I'm figuring it's because of the milling process, because it's been split.
That's what we suspect. It was a very finely milled flour, and as a result, of course, it had good mouthfeel, it tasted great.
It looked really healthy.
Yeah. Subsequently, having learned from our naive mistakes, I suppose, in the first study.
I suppose it's assumptions, isn't it?
Pardon me?
It's assumptions, isn't it? One would assume that a wholemeal bread would take longer to digest. It's what you would assume.
Yeah, exactly. And it looked great. It was a wonderful looking bread. It tasted wonderful. So market wise, it would be successful. But subsequently, we decided that instead of making our own breads, which we had been doing up to this point, that we really weren't bakers, and that it might make sense to look at some of the commercial breads and compare them to our sourdough white bread that we had tested. And we linked up with what, at least in Canada, we refer to as a baker, who is a smaller operation who gets into some of the whole grain bread. It's the sourdough breads, not the big commercial enterprises.
Uh-huh.
And what we found when we used some of their breads was that the whole grain with a sourdough base showed a very positive response. And something that perhaps you can appreciate is that the bread that showed the most positive response was a sprouted grain sourdough-based bread.
Right, so that really did make a big difference.
Yes, it did.
And do you think that the enzymes, obviously, in sprouted bread make change the way in fact, it can accelerate, in some cases, the rise. If you add in, say, diacetic malt diax, for example, that will accelerate and help things along.
Yeah.
When you say sprouted, how far sprouted? Were they semi-sprouted or just literally?
Well, I asked the baker, and he said they're sprouted for about 24 hours. And as a non-baker and not a food scientist or a botanist, I can't tell you much more than that.
So when you say sprouted, just so I get this right, the grain is sprouted and then milled.
Yes, I believe. I can't answer that. I don't know. You'd have to contact the company. The other thing that I found interesting is that the owner of the company, the baker, told me, because he doesn't use any preservatives, that he found that his sprouted grain breads had a longer shelf life of about 24 to 48 hours before there was any problem with a mold or anything like that. And he and I speculated, and again, this Ricky Yada, who's a very good food scientist, agreed and found some information to back it up, that any seed that starts to sprout, of course, is hoping to produce a plant.
Yeah.
And so there's going to be all sorts of changes in the carbohydrate of the seed. And also, it would start to, if I was that seed, I'd be producing any compound I could to prevent bacteria or molds or anything else, any fungus from affecting me, because I'm going to produce a plant. And at the same time, the nature of the carbohydrates in that seed could well start to change, because now they're going to be the energy to grow the plant.
So anything that might threaten the plant, such as mold or fungus, would be there's a defense mechanism against it.
Sure.
As a defense,
This is one of my potentially good ideas that sat on my desk as I.
As you ran out of time to do them all. Oh, bless. Well, it's. I think even the studies that you've done really make a difference to. I mean, I have people coming to me all the time, almost every single week, where people come to me with problems with bread, and some of those problems are allergies. Some of them are problems digesting. Some of them are problems with the fact that they need to lower their blood sugars. And I think that a study like this, certainly from my point of view, when I teach people how to make their own sourdough and how to make their own artisan bread at home, it makes a huge difference to their confidence levels, because they go home like, you know what, I'm in control of my own health here. And that empowers people, and that information empowers bakers. And so the work that you've done has, and you know, as I've quoted you, I just thought I'd better go and speak to you, because I've been quoting your studies and it's amazing, but I kind of wanted to get a little bit more my head around it, because if I chat with such familiarity about you and your studies, I ought to at least have made sure I've understood everything correctly.
Well, thank you.
Well, it makes a difference to people, Terry, it really does.
It does, and I think one of the problems, of course, is finding these breads, at least in Canada. Because most of our breads are from these huge, big commercial enterprises.
And a lot of them are not actually...
They're interested in sourdough.
No, and they're not... And also, the ones that are from the big commercial bakeries are not actually sourdough. I've been in some of the large yeast manufacturing processes and the yeast manufacturers, and they produce sourdough in a sachet. And then there's no regulation here in the UK. And what they can call sourdough and what is actually long, slow fermented with bacteria are quite different. So they are, I think, at some point going to have to regulate what is called sourdough and what is not.
And, of course, the bakery I interacted with told me that the big enterprises avoid sourdough because it's a much more complex, tedious process than the regular bread.
No, I actually, you know what? I have to argue with that. It really isn't. I think it's just simply a matter of understanding it. Mm-hmm. It's just timing. Aside from timing and looking after your starter, which really is very easy, it really isn't a much... I mean, the French...
Mm-hmm.
I've worked in bakeries all over, and it's really not any different to make sourdough. It's just timing, really.
Mm-hmm. The other thing I was going to mention to you is there have been a few studies, mainly from Norway, I believe, where they, instead of using sourdough, they added an acid, a vinegar or whatever, to the bread, or even studied to the recipe, rather, or even to the bread after it was baked, and showed a difference in how the the blood sugar responded. And this would support, I suppose, the fairly popular activity, eating activity that some people have now, taking bread with some olive oil and balsamic vinegar and so on. And that this could well, even after the processing of the bread, be a healthy way to ingest it.
So, I mean, that then holds theory with the Mediterranean diet, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
So, because there have been a lot of cases where people are unable to explain the Mediterranean effect, or in fact, the French paradox.
Yes.
Where, in actual fact, drinking, I mean, I can't remember a meal where in the south of France that my people in the village would not drink a glass of fairly rough red wine with mm-hmm. their meal, because I lived in the south of France from the age of about 9. I lived there next to a bakery. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, we are sourdough with a large glass of red wine lunchtime and evening meal.
Well, that sounds wonderful to me. the other aspect that I'll just throw out in passing, I suppose, my work was before this with the carbohydrate side of nutrition was associated with caffeine.
I've just missed that slightly. Was generally on caffeine.
It was with coffee and caffeine.
Right. I've just had a coffee actually before I interviewed you because I wanted to be bright. So I had one about 20 minutes before I called you, just so I was on the ball.
Well, our work for a number of years demonstrated that if you have caffeine or caffeine and coffee and follow that with carbohydrate, that you are, the caffeine causes an insulin resistance. That is, your blood sugars go higher, etc., for a period of at least 3 to 6 hours. So if you were a type 2 diabetic or borderline, I'd be suggesting a sourdough, whole grain or sprouted grain bread, and drinking decaf. Drinking decaf, or at least avoiding caffeine. But I say decaf because, paradoxically, although our work and the work of others shows pretty very strongly that caffeine interferes with that drink of coffee, large amounts of coffee, for decades, decreases the risk for type 2 diabetes.
So, if you...
You look confused.
I am a little.
And I was too when that work started to come out. And the first study was actually done in the Netherlands. But what it amounts to is this... I think scientists pretty much agree that caffeine interferes with insulin.
And is that so? That's a bad thing. So having a coffee and a cake is a bad thing.
Mm-hmm. But at the same time, coffee has hundreds, if not hundreds, of biologically active ingredients, and some of these are the coffee's very rich in some of these, and they produce long term health benefits.
Because I've been drinking bulletproof coffee with the coconut oil.
What about?
I have my coffee with a spoon of coconut oil.
Okay.
It's called bulletproof coffee.
Okay.
It's quite well known at the moment.
Yeah, it is. That's true, and I can't really comment on that one, but certainly coffee drinking is associated with lower risk of a whole spectrum of diseases, including type 2 diabetes.
And is that including just having one cup a day? I have one cup of really good, strong coffee in just after lunch, about 2 o'clock.
Yeah. No, biological studies, which are about the only meaningful ones that have been done, you need huge bodies of data collected for decades, would suggest that the improvements, the decreased risk, appears to start with 1 to 3 cups a day, and certainly would go on to 3 to 5, 5 to 7 with decreased risk. And part of the problem with these studies, of course, is just what is a cup of coffee?
I was going to say, my cup of coffee is an organic, fair trade, very strong cup of quite large coffee.
Yeah.
Black.
It would probably have more of these powerful antioxidants and so on in it. Every study that I've seen has been done, and there have not been a lot of them, all report the same thing. A really pronounced decreased risk of not just type 2 diabetes, but some cancers, some neurological aging aspects, and so on. But at the same time, these decreased risks are not associated with caffeine. It's other ingredients in the coffee.
Right. So it's kind of like a dual-edged sword.
It is.
Yeah.
And so if you're a healthy individual, have whatever coffee you like. And I hope I'm healthy because I drink caffeinated coffee.
But do you eat sourdough?
Yes, as often as I can find it, I'll have sourdough.
Do you not make it?
No, I used to make bread.
Would you like me, in return for your information, I'm very happy to teach you to make sourdough bread.
That'd be great.
If I'll give you the codes to go into my website later, and I can post you some sourdough starter, and I'll get you going. And I bet within a week I'll have you making the most beautiful sourdough bread.
Well, it might take more than a week because our house is still ripped apart in renovations.
Okay.
As soon as we have a really functional house, I would be delighted to have a sourdough.
I was going to say, Terry, you can't do all those amazing studies on all that and not make your own sourdough. That's just not on.
Okay.
I'll swap you your wonderful interview with some sourdough. So I'll put you on the sourdough club. And I'll send, and all on there, there's your step-by-step guide, there's all the photographs, there is an absolute idiot-proof guide to making your own sourdough.
I like idiot-proof.
Yeah, you can't, they'll have a step-by-step, literally picture with each instruction recipe, so you'll be fine.
Okay. I was going to ask you as well, at least in North America, the fad is probably finished because fads only last a week or two, but there was an incredible fad last year in 2014 against the eating of bread.
Oh, the no-knead technique.
Yeah.
I do use a no-knead technique, but that doesn't mean to say that the gluten isn't stretched. I use it's a lift and fold method, which effectively stretches the gluten in the bowl. So what you get is it's a lot less intense, it's a lot less messy, but it has the same result. But at the same time, and again, I can't give you the 100% scientific explanation, but the long, slow fermentation process helps pull the gluten together. So the gluten strengthens on its own. So there is a lot to be said for no-knead technique.
Yeah. It wasn't just the gluten. There was a very popular book called Wheat Belly.
I've got it.
Yeah.
Have you read it?
No.
Right, I have read it. So
I saw a couple of interviews by the author and I thought, he doesn't know what he's talking about, but he's selling a lot of books.
Yeah, there are so many things that have affected the way in which we digest bread. Mm-hmm. And from starting with hybridization of grain, the grain itself, the chromosomes, there is also studies to show that fertilizer nitrogen has affected the amount of gliadin that is in the gluten. And the structure of the gliadin, the way in which we mill it, the way in which we ferment it, the way in which we bake it, the length of time, the raising agents, the enzymes that are then used in the baking process. There are so many factors that have basically distorted bread to the point where our bodies no longer recognise it as bread. So I can understand why it's a popular book.
Mm-hmm.